brutality in Jewish law. And we have a couple of sign-up sheets going around. The sign-up sheets serve two purposes. One is we like to know in general who's coming to sessions, and so please do sign in. And then the other is there's an option there to check if you want to receive our weekly email, which notifies you about upcoming programs, so you can find out more about programs like this. Okay. Police brutality. So here's the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is that Jewish law strictly forbids violence in general. I am not allowed to harm somebody else. As a matter of fact, I am not allowed to license somebody else to harm me. If I walk up to somebody and I say, "Hit me," and he says, "Well, no, I'll get in trouble." And I say, "No, I forgive you in advance. I will not sue you. I will not hold you responsible. I would like you to do it." Not allowed. He's not prohibited to harm me. A person is held responsible even for accidental harm. The Talmudic principle is adam mu'ad le'olam. A person is considered forewarned forever. Meaning that if I go to sleep, and in my sleep I roll over and I lash out and hit somebody and wound them or break somebody's property, I am responsible for the fact that I lay down over there. A human being is always considered to be responsible for the results of their actions. And the Torah goes very far with that in terms of holding people responsible for harming others. On the other hand, as we're going to see, the Torah recognizes a position of police officer, in which it licenses the police officer to use force against other people. So even though we have prohibitions against the use of force, nonetheless, we have some kind of licensed opportunity for a person to, in fact, use force to detain people and so forth. So the question is, how does the system of Jewish ethics manage these poles between, on the one hand, saying, no, 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 you can't harm others, and on the other hand, saying, well, there's a particular person who we are empowering and licensing within society to do just that. What is this person licensed to do? What is the person not licensed to do? And if the person, in fact, steps over the line, what are the modes what are the remedies available for a citizen who feels that the police did step over the line? So I brought you here at the top a one-line summary or two-line summary of a recent case right here in Toronto. Well, recent in the sense that it just came in through the courts. The actual attack happened in 2012, because we know the way that works. But the story was, a fellow by the name of El Mardi was walking along the street, and it was nighttime. It was in an area that's considered a somewhat dangerous area. And an officer from Toronto's Tavis Bureau, which is an anti-violence bureau, stops him from his car and asks him where he's going. He apparently responds in some belligerent way, something along the lines of, "None of your business." Perhaps a little more colorful than that. The officer steps out of the car and punches him. And now, of course, the two accounts deviate in terms of what actually happened. He alleges, "I had done nothing. And, maybe I was rude in responding, but that was it. And the officer slugged me and knocked me to the ground, picked me up, hit me again, kicked me, took all my papers out of my pocket and dropped them on the ground. It was wintertime and I was left on an icy porch for half an hour. They asked me where I was from, and I told them I was from Sudan, and he asked me why I don't go back there," and so on and so forth. Develops a story of racially motivated attack. Whereas the officer says that he felt that he was in danger. This fellow El Mardi has his hands in his pockets, and therefore there was concern that he might be carrying a weapon. And he was what's called blading, which means he had angled himself away from the police car in such a way that it looked like he was concealing a weapon. And the officer therefore felt he was at risk. I never asked him where he was from. I never made any racial comments and so on. And the fellow did in fact have bruises to prove that he had been punched. That part of it wasn't subject to debate. But the question is, in a case like this, aside from the question of how do you play detective and figure out who actually is telling the truth, and the decision is an interesting decision because the judge actually does some detective work in terms of figuring this out. So, for example, on the card that the officer had filled out afterwards, the officer describes the color of El Marty's shirt. El Marty says the officer pulled his coat down on this 10 below night in winter and had it down for half an hour, and the officer claimed they never opened his coat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like Encyclopedia Brown type of detective work. Well, how did you know what color his shirt was if you never opened his coat? But aside from the question of how you do the detective work, fundamentally, let's say you determine that the officer really stopped this person without cause and in fact punched the person without cause. What would Jewish law say? In the verdict in the Toronto case, the result was, in fact, that they held the officer liable for various infringements of rights, and he had to pay damages for it. But what would Jewish law say? So in order to address this question, which clearly is a big question in the news, you know, has been a question in the news a lot over the last several months, whether you talk about Ferguson, or you talk about Baltimore, or you talk about New York, we've had our own cases in Canada. The opening question has to be, what exactly is a police officer in Jewish law? How do we define the position of a police officer, given that, as I've said, we're not supposed to actually use violence on others? So we have to define what a police officer is. Then we have to ask the question of, when is a police officer licensed to use force? And how do we define excessive force, and what remedies are available? That's the basic path that I want to walk with this. As always, feel free to interrupt in between, you know, during any comments. And that's what allows me to drink my soda. So, we start with what a police officer is. And I brought you paragraph 18 of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Act, because I think we're going to see something really interesting in terms of descriptions of the role of the police within Canadian law and within Jewish law. So it starts number one. It is the duty of members who are peace officers, subject to the orders of the commissioner, A, to perform all duties that are assigned to peace officers in relation to the preservation of the peace, the prevention of crime and of offenses against the laws of Canada, and the laws in force in any province in which they may be employed, and the apprehension of criminals and offenders and others who may be lawfully taken into custody. Okay, that's a big paragraph. Right? What are the responsibilities of a police officer? And then paragraph A, to put it into non-legalese. What is it that a police officer is supposed to do? Keep the peace. And that translates into action how?
Detain.
Well, there's detaining of who?
Prevention, and there's also dealing with the officers.
Lawfully.
Right, lawfully detaining, but as Jonathan says, and thank you, Jonathan, for arranging this, and I didn't mention in the beginning, so I thank Schwartz-Savitsky Feldman for providing lunch, but the prevention of crime, right, against the laws of Canada, against the laws of any province, but the prevention of crime is one piece of their responsibility. Then, after the crime has taken place, the apprehension of criminals, offenders, and others who may be lawfully taken into custody. I imagine that others means somebody you suspect, but you don't have enough on them to be able to say that they are criminals. Only that you have a legitimate suspicion such that you're allowed to take them into custody, at least for some period of investigation. Then B, to execute all warrants and perform all duties and services in relation thereto that may, under this act or the laws of Canada or the laws in force in any province, be lawfully executed and performed by peace officers. Sometimes there are duties which are duties of the police, execution of warrants as it says here, that subject to whatever laws are governing this, police officers are meant to carry out. So I imagine that what we're talking about here is a search warrant, right? That's the easiest and simplest. So there is a warrant, which is for police to carry out. That's one thing that police officers are going to do. When they execute a search warrant, who is employing them? Who is the police officer's boss, so to speak, when he's carrying out the warrant?
Courts. government.
The courts. Right, it's the courts, not the government, as much as it is the courts. That's going to matter. That's why I want to make sure to note that. C. To perform all duties that may be lawfully be performed by peace officers in relation to the escort and conveyance of convicts and other persons in custody to or from any courts, places of punishment or confinement, asylums, or other places. Right? To escort convicts and others who are in custody to or from courts, places of punishment, and so on. Again, who is the boss of the police officer? The courts. And then D, such other duties and functions as are prescribed by the governor and council or the commissioner. Okay, that's a boilerplate line. If there's anything that we didn't say in A, B, and C, we'll you know, include that in D. Fundamentally, yeah. I'm sorry?
This law is the governor.
Right.
The council and the commissioner.
Correct. We don't envision a situation in which a judge is able to change the job description of the police officer. The judge would have to work through counsel in order to rewrite the law effectively, which is a standard checks and balances system. Right? The way that we work things in terms of checks and balances normally is you have a legislature, and the legislature writes the law. And you have judges who are the ones who decide that the law is actually legitimate, and they'll hear challenges to the law. I'm coming at this from the United States, but my understanding is that the systems are similar in that regard. Fundamentally, the police officer as defined here in A as well as B and C seems to be an agent of the law, an agent of the court. Even though the law is going to be written by the legislature, he's acting on behalf of the court. Now let's shift gears and talk about what happens within a Jewish setting. Anybody know the term in Hebrew for police?
Shoter.
Right. So the police department is the mishtara. The individual police is a shoter.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. Take a look at source number 2. Jerry's right on the ball.
Shoter is plural.
Correct. So take a look at source number 2. Source number 2 is the opening verse of the Torah portion called Shoftim. Verse from Deuteronomy. Shoftim v'shoterim titein lecha v'chol she'arecha asher Hashem alakecha nosein lecha lishvatecha. You shall place judges, a shofet is a judge, and officers, a shoter is an officer. You shall place them b'chol she'arecha at all of your gates which God gives you for your tribes. V'shoftu esa'am mishpat tzedek, and they shall judge the nation righteously. The position of a shoter, of a police officer, is in fact a biblical position. The sages saw it as a necessity. It said judges and police officers are absolutely necessary, and one cannot function without the other. If you take a look at source number 3, this is from a Midrash Tanchuma, a little bit of a word about Midrash, just to explain. Midrash is rabbinic commentary on biblical verses. It is generally a response to a nuance in the text, where the rabbis see something in a text and say, there's something there that doesn't belong. It must be there to teach me something. It is a process. The process of Midrash is literally thousands of years old. The written versions of Midrash that we have were written down anywhere between, in certain cases, 2,000, 2,100 years ago to about 800 years ago. Those are the classic volumes of Midrash. Midrash Tanchuma is one of the later ones, but it's in terms of when it was written down, but this is quoting a very early idea that we find corroborated in various rabbinic texts. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Rabbi Elazar said, in Ein Shoter, Ein Shofet. He said, if there's no officer, there's no judge. And he explains what he means by that. Ketzad, how so? Kevan shnischayev adam bebezdin lachavero. If a person becomes liable in court for somebody else, he's bound to owe somebody else. Im ein shom shoter sheyotzi mimenu. If you don't have an officer to produce the payment, kevan shepereish min hadayanim ein sveka biadadayim lasos lo klum. So he says, once he leaves the court, It's over. It's game over. There's no way the judge can actually compel him to pay. The judge said guilty, and he says, thank you very much, have a nice day. And that's it. So, unless, Ellen Kane Mostro Biata Shoter, unless you can give him to the officer, and it's the officer's job to compel payment. Bashoter Motsimi Menu, the officer will be the one to actually get the payment from him. What's bothering the rabbis here that makes them make this comment in source number 3, I think, is the fact that in source number 2, the biblical verse lumped them together. Right? The biblical verse put them together. It said, judges and officers you shall place in your gate, putting them side by side, but the only verb was the verb of, you shall judge the nation. It didn't actually give a verb for the shoter, for the officer. It didn't say, you shall hit people. It didn't say what he's supposed to do. It didn't say arrest people. None of the duties that we saw in source number 1 are listed there in that biblical verse. And so the rabbis are bothered. You told me to appoint a shoter, an officer, but you didn't tell me what his job description is. And so what they're answering in source number 3 is, his job description is to make sure that justice is served. To make sure that the judge will actually perform a meaningful role. That's what the Midrash is picking up on here.
But then we have to decide what justice means. Who's justice?
Absolutely. And that's, to a certain extent, beyond the scope of where we're going to go, except to say, we are assuming that when the judge says something, that the judge is acting in the name of the justice system in a proper way. That's the default.
But if anything here, you see, what is the function of the shoter is to be an enforcement as opposed to being proactive in preventing crime. It's not
correct.
That is the emphasis of at least the biblical emphasis.
Correct. That's true. We've only said here, at least within this Midrash, that he's enforcing the decisions. We didn't say anything about proactively preventing crime. We have not gone there yet. I emphasize yet. Take a look, please, at source number 4.
And also, why do we have modern-day based in it if we don't have police officers to support them?
A very good question. Hold the thought. We're going to come back to it. Source number 4. It's from Moses Maimonides. We're now fast-forwarding to the 12th century Common Era in Egypt, but he's basing himself on the Talmud's understanding of the verse in source number 2. We're just leapfrogging steps in the process to get to Maimonides. He says in source number 4, Mitzvahs asei shel Torah limnos shoftim v'shotrim b'chol medina u'medina u'v'chol plach u'plach. He says there is a biblical command to appoint judges and officers everywhere, and he quotes the verse that we had in number 2. The ellipsis is just because I didn't bother bringing the same verse all over again. And he says, shoftim, judges, these are the judges who are fixed in every location and the litigants come to them. Shotrim, Elu Bali Makil Uritsua. These are the wielders of the staff and the lash. And they stand in front of the judges. And then, if you're a student of Hebrew, you'll recognize there's a problem. The next word in the Hebrew, Hamasavavin, doesn't indicate whether the antecedent is the judge or the officer. And so there's some debate about that, but I'm going to go with the mainstream read of this line, which is that it's referring to the officer, and it's saying, not only does the officer stand in front of the judge, but also, Hamisavavin Bashvakim Uvarachovot, they also circulate in the markets and in the streets, Valachanuyot, and the stores, Letaken Hasharim Vahamidot. His job is to make sure that all the prices are fixed properly. Because going back to Talmudic times, and we discussed this when we had our discussion about OPEC and price fixing, going back to Talmudic times, the Jewish system of doing business, when they lived under the Romans, was very much like the Roman system, in the sense that there were fixed prices. You were not allowed to just charge whatever you wanted for a life necessity. So if they found that somebody was overcharging, or undercutting everybody else, their job as officers was to tell him, you're not going to do that, or you're going to feel the makel ritzua, the staff and the lash. Further, hamidot, to make sure that all the measures were honest. You had a bureau of weights and measures. Ulhakot kol me'aveit, as well as to strike anyone who was corrupt. V'chol ma'aseihem al pi ha'dayanim, and all of their deeds are at the word of the sages. Of the judges, I should say, sorry. V'chol she'iru bo ivut davar, and if they see anybody acting corruptly, mivin oto lebeit din v'danin oto kefi rish'o, they bring him to court, and they judge him according to his wickedness. Now, this is clearly more than just carrying out the verdict. We're now being proactive to prevent crime. We're now circulating to make sure that people use honest weights and measures. Maimonides did not invent this on his own. He drew it from Talmudic sources that we're going to see in a moment. that's a definition of the role of the officers that emphasizes punishing at the judge's instruction, but also adds components. Now, the question was asked, why would you have a court today, a rabbinical court, if you don't have the ability to carry out these punishments? If indeed, without an officer, there is no judge, then what exactly are you doing? So, in fact, rabbinic writing suggests that the only purpose for having... that you wouldn't be allowed to carry out physical harm today. In other words, even if you lived in a land where the secular authorities said, we empower Jewish courts to do as they please. Okay, it existed at one point in 13th century Spain. There was actually a period of time under James II where Jewish courts were empowered to do as they wished to carry out Jewish law on Jewish populations. It has happened. Even still, we would not be empowered to carry this out because you require a level of rabbinic ordination that hasn't existed since the 5th century Common Era. The only purpose for which we would be licensed to carry out use of force would be what's called the migdar milta, to literally to fence things in. And that would be if you had a situation in which you had someone who was running rampant and who nobody could control, who didn't listen to the law, and who the secular authorities did not have power to contain, then they would be empowered to do this. Barring that, they wouldn't. And the rabbinical courts, once they lose that ability of enforcement, definitely lose some strength, but they still have a mission to carry out. The mission of trying to execute justice between parties still exists. And so basically what we're told is we're doing the best we can with it, even knowing that we're not going to be able to actually force somebody to accept the decision. That's more or less the way that it works.
We have some.
Yeah.
It's a higher.
Right, and I'm going to come to that. Good point. Jay points out we have the option of something called excommunication, although that also has lost its meaning entirely in our day. But yes, we're going to have to come back to that as well. Another aspect of the powers of the police, I didn't bring a source for it here because it's a long and involved topic, but is the issue of arresting a flight risk. If you have somebody who should be judged, but you're afraid he's going to flee, then indeed they have the ability to detain. You see it biblically. There are a couple of cases biblically in which a person commits a crime and then they put him in what's called mishmar, where they guard him until they know what they're going to do with him. I'm not quite sure why there needs to be guarded. There's nowhere for him to run. They're in the wilderness. But nonetheless, they put him into solitary, so to speak, to be held on to. Another case in which this comes up is if somebody strikes another person, and that person is now confined to bed, and we don't know whether they're going to live or die. So that's another case in which we are told, keep the assailant in prison until we see exactly what happens. Is this person going to recover or not recover, which will determine what the charges are. The whole idea of prison in general in Jewish law is a fascinating one and worthy of discussion, because generally speaking, Jewish law is against restraining somebody's freedom of movement. But that's a longer discussion. The third piece of his job, in addition to punishing at the judge's instruction, in addition to arresting a flight risk, is to enforce Jewish law. And under this principle of enforcing Jewish law, it's actually fairly strong, a police officer is able to use force in the event that he sees people are not fulfilling their religious obligations. So if he sees that somebody is, let's say, in one case that the Talmud mentions, there's a mitzvah on Sukkot, on the Festival of Tabernacles, of taking four plant species and using them in a ritual. Lulav and Esrog, Hadas and Arava, those are the four species, and it's part of the prayers for rain that occur at that time of year, in the fall. And the Talmud says, if you see somebody who refuses, who says, I'm not going to carry this out, they actually have the ability to use force on him in order to get him to do so. Another example that is perhaps more familiar, because it makes it into the media every once in a while, a man is supposed to give a bill of divorce to his wife, and he refuses, so the line is, Kofin oso achioma rotza ani, you compel him until he says, I am willing. What that means, the parameters of doing that, great discussion also for another time. But this is brought talmudically, and in fact later as well, as the right of the, not the right, the role of the police officer. And then the final role of the police officer is enforcer of municipal regulations. If you take a look at source number 5, we already saw this in Maimonides in number 4, but now I'm showing you where he gets it from in the Talmud. There's a biblical verse that says, Evan Shlema Batzedek Yiyelach, honest, literally an honest stone, but it also mentions other weights and measures. Honest weights and measures shall be for you. And the Talmud draws from this statement of shall be for you that proactively we try to create that. Melamed Shema Amidin Agardim in Lemidos. That teaches that community is supposed to appoint officers over the measures. Ve'in Amidin Agardim in Lesharim. But the Talmud says not in terms of prices. We're not going to have armed guards circulating to make sure that prices are being kept. But then we find out, they mention here, that the house of the prince, prince was a political position, not literally a prince, but the Nasi was somebody who was in charge of the Jewish community living in Israel under the Romans in this particular story. They appointed officers for measures as well as prices, because there was a disagreement about that, whether we appoint them just for the sake of honest weights and measures or also for prices. But the point is that going back to the Talmud, we had this principle that we would in fact appoint people for honest weights and measures and proper prices. And what we see here is a set of roles that largely mirrors the roles of the RCMP. Right? When you think about what we define for the RCMP, they are agents of the court. And here we're going to see very clearly in a moment, even more clearly, that the officer is an agent of the court. We already saw the way he's linked to the shofet, he's linked to the judge. The job is to punish at the judge's instruction, to detain somebody if he's a flight risk, to enforce regulations. Granted that within the Jewish system you have Jewish law as part of that, and you know, Canada not having a particular state religion will not have that as part of their roles of the police officer. But other than that, the roles are strikingly similar, even though you're talking about a gap of a couple of thousand years between when Jewish law set it out and when they set up the RCMP Act. I don't imagine that the RCMP Act was drafted based on the sources in the Talmud. However, Talmudic sources were very influential on the formation of various early forms of law, number one, and that has filtered down in a variety of ways in terms of English law and how that has affected law in North America as well. But number two, I think it's common sense. This is what we need police officers to do, to punish people, to prevent crime, and to enforce regulations. And again, in both systems, we see that the officer is a function of the court, acting based on the word of the judges. For example, if you take a look back at Maimonides in source number 4, when he wrote explicitly, all of their deeds are at the words of the judges. There was a rabbi in Israel in the 1950s, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who was a great authority in Jewish law, who wrote quite a bit on the role of police officers. It's always very interesting when you're trying to come up with the role of the police officer, because there's this very large gap in Jewish history when we didn't have armed police officers of our own. You don't find a whole lot of writing about it until the modern state of Israel, because we weren't in a position to do it. You find it in Talmudic times, and then suddenly, you know, you don't find a whole lot. Maimonides writes about it because he writes about everything. But other than that, you don't really see it. So Rabbi Chaim David Halevi filled in a lot of the gaps on this, and he actually requires that the police officer receive certification like a judge, because he's very concerned with the point that I made in the beginning, which is that we are against use of force. And he's worried, what's to stop the officer from using it improperly? So he requires that the officer actually receive training and ordination like a judge in order to be able to function properly. And he has various sources to support that idea. For example, if you take a look at source number 6, passage out of the Talmud, which says they're dealing with marriage issues and how you know somebody to be Jewish. And the passage here says, anyone whose ancestors were known to have been public officers and tzedakah collectors is allowed to marry among the Kohanim, the priests. You don't have to check their lineage. We know they're good. So what? So Rabbi Menachem Meiri, writing in the 14th century, commenting on this text, says, Shotrei Rabin, public officers, he translates that as Dayanim Ba'alma, judges. And he says, these are judges who don't have a courtroom, but instead they circulate. And that's what they said. He actually called police officers judges. So what we've seen so far is just groundwork, but very important groundwork. We've now explained that the license for a police officer in Jewish law to use force stems from the biblical obligation to create officers and have them serve as agents of the court, just like we see with the RCMP. Parenthetically, we're dealing with Jewish law. What about secular society? Would Jewish law recognize secular society's ability to create police officers and have them use force? What would you say?
Sure. Yeah.
On what basis? Well, Dina de Malchusa is one possibility. The principle Chaim quotes, the law of the land is the law, and is recognized by Jewish law. What else? There are 7 Noahide laws, right? There are 7 laws that are given to all humanity within the Torah. And one of them is the commandment to create a system of courts, which includes enforcing the law. So you have to recognize that, in fact, they have the ability as well. What that means, what are the limits, is a very good question. But fundamentally, it's not just Jewish law that will have this, but Jewish law will recognize as well, within a secular system, the ability for police officers to use force. So that brings us now... Yeah?
May I ask, does the Code of Hammurabi at all figure in any of these figurings?
So they certainly had use of force in the Code of Hammurabi, and yes, it was an agent of the court who would carry it out. I didn't look through to see how extensive their description of a police officer would have been. I would be surprised if it varied greatly from what we're seeing here, because of the latter point I made before about this being sort of a common sense description of what society needs, and also knowing that within the Code of Hammurabi, they also had rules about weights and measures and so on, and somebody would have to be the enforcer for it, and knowing that their courts did indeed have the ability to carry out physical penalties. So it would make sense, but I didn't actually research it for this. Thank you.
Was there a training process for becoming a police officer and for collecting tzedakah in Jewish past?
Right.
For collecting tzedakah as well?
So, in terms of the police officer, that was Rabbi Chaim David Halevi's point. He said, absolutely, they have to have a full training program to make sure that they don't use force improperly. In terms of tzedakah, it's a good question. You had laws governing what they could do and how they could do it. So that regulations in terms of transparency, making sure that they always go around with a second person, that they not handle the money in any way that someone might suspect them of saving some for themselves, who they were allowed to ask for funds, there are restrictions on who they can ask and how they can ask. That suggests some kind of training, but not necessarily. It could just be that you told them, okay, here's the rule book, and then set them out. One thing that makes me think that you didn't necessarily have a training program is there's a lot of discussion about accountability of tzedakah collectors. And if the tzedakah collector is somebody who everybody accepts and knows to be good, then we say that he is suggested to provide an accounting of how it was dispersed, but he's not required to. Whereas if it's somebody who does not have an established track record within the community, then he's actually required to provide a public accounting of how it was used. Yes, transparency is not a new idea. But based on that distinction, that suggests that they didn't have a clear training program, or everybody would have gone through the program and you only would have accepted the ones you trusted. Right. It's also possible that you ran the risk of, if you're going to be too demanding and you're not going to find someone to actually do the job, it's not necessarily a job people run to do. So when is the officer allowed to use force? There are two cases where it's clearly expected that the judge is going to, that the officer will use force. Number one, carrying out the judge's verdict, right? Like we talked about. That's obvious. Number two would be saving somebody from an assailant. I brought you in source number 7. Maimonides codifies this, but it's a very old idea. It goes back to biblical law. That if one person, I'm going to read it in the English in the interests of time, but you can see the Hebrew as well. If one person is pursuing somebody else to kill him, then all Israel are commanded to save the pursued individual from the pursuer, even if the pursuer is a minor and therefore doesn't necessarily understand what he's doing. It doesn't make a difference. Even at the cost of the pursuer's life. This is a law called in Hebrew, rodef, a pursuer. And if they warn him and he continues the pursuit, then even if he doesn't accept the warning, and the reason we need to say that is because normally to use force to punish somebody, they have to beforehand understand what they're doing wrong and show that they actually heard the warning. But in this case, when you're saving somebody's life from the pursuer, even if he doesn't demonstrate having heard the warning, nonetheless, he would be stopped even at the cost of his life if necessary. What about the use of force outside of this framework? You're not saving the life of a victim. You're not carrying out the judge's penalty. Let's say the following. You are the police officer, and you have been sent to somebody's home to summon him to court for some kind of a trial. He sees you show up at his door. He says, I'm not going. You refuse. He thumbs his nose at you. You insist. He thumbs his nose at you and says, forget it. I'm not going. I'm not interested in anything you have to say. What are your options? The answer is, it is, of course, a debate. We have two different views. Brought in the Code of Jewish Law, each view is quoting earlier authorities. Source number 8, the Code of Jewish Law itself, written down in the 16th century Common Era. But again, they're quoting much earlier sources from centuries past. The first view is presented by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was writing in Israel. He says, officially based in Aser Lino Kalus Rosh. He says, you're not allowed to treat an agent of the court lightly. Not only are you not allowed to treat the judge lightly, the judge's agent also. And if someone pains him, he's trying to do his job, and they are refusing to comply, the court is licensed to strike with lashes for rebellion. And the agent can testify that he scorned him, for the purpose of excommunication. Jerry asked about excommunication. Here we see it surface. According to Rabbi Karo, what exactly is the agent able to do? Is the agent able to apply force?
Yes.
Yes or no? We got a yes and a bunch of no's. Correct. Rabbi Yosef Karo says the court is licensed to do it. He has to go back to the court, report what's going on, and the court has to decide what to do. The police officer is not allowed to use force on someone who is, so to speak, resisting arrest. Then you get Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who's quoting an earlier authority, Rabbeinu Yerucham. And he says, he may personally act against one who refuses to comply, striking him. And if he harms his property, he's exempt from liability. This is actually a debate in terms of what the proxy of the court, this police officer, is allowed to do. How much discretion does he really have in terms of using force? Rabbi Karo says he does not have the option. Rabbi Isserles disagrees and says he may use force. The weight of earlier authorities is really with Rabbi Karo's position, that he would not be allowed to use force in this case, and you can see why. Right? Why would we not empower him to do so?
There's no imminent threat here.
There's no imminent threat.
You don't know where it'll stop.
Innocent until proven guilty. You don't know where it'll stop. And fundamentally, we're very uncomfortable with the idea of use of force. Yeah.
In Israel, what about how police were sent to dismantle settlements in Amona, and they used undue horrible force as representatives of a Jewish court?
Right. So Janice points out a particular problem, and it's actually wasn't the police, it was the military that was sent in, you know, in that case. And that is a very good question. But they're being ordered to do this by a judge. And one of the major objections to the way that was carried out was the fact that the military was turned into a police force. effectively, which they're not, or as one person put it, a manpower agency. And so there were real issues with that. But the question there is with the judge. By what right does the judge order this? And that's a good discussion also we can have at some point. But the general tendency in Jewish law is to be biased against use of force, such that Rabbi Isserles is really the surprising one when he says that you are allowed to use force and you're exempt from liability for having done so. So to summarize, we have these various roles for the police officer. Clearly the officer is able to use force at the instruction of the judge and in order to save lives. And it's debatable whether he can use force in other duties as well, such as preventing a crime or carrying out the warrant. Which leads us to the question of excessive use of force and liability. Let's say, within Rabbi Caro's point of view, police officer goes to the house, knocks on the door, the fellow says, I'm not going with you. He says, come with me, and he grabs his arm and he pulls him out. Maybe he bruises his wrist when he pulls him out. Maybe the guy's clothing gets torn. Is the police officer going to be liable? That would be one question. Within the view of Rabbi Isserles, who licenses use of force, let's say he tugs him outside, the fellow refuses, and he turns around and he slugs the guy on the jaw. Is there a limit to what Rabbi Isserles is willing to accept when he says you're allowed to use force? How far are you allowed to go? So we have precedent for dealing with this as well within Jewish law.
When did you say above, were you going to go days?
Yes.
You allowed to kill the days. He's coming off to kill you.
Yeah.
You have a license, or you're according to Allah, you can kill the days.
Correct.
So wouldn't that apply here too? That if somebody's,
right. So Jerry points out that we did say that when somebody is pursuing another to harm him, to kill him, then you're allowed to defend yourself even at the cost of the life of the pursuer. But I would note two things. Number one, you're assuming that the officer's life is in danger. The case I gave, the fellow would be very happy if the officer went on his way. He hasn't drawn a weapon. He hasn't demonstrated any interest in harming the officer. That's number one. Number two, we also said in that same law, source number 7, the end of the paragraph, we said if you can manage it without killing him, that's what you're supposed to do. So it's not, you know, we wouldn't take that necessarily into this.
I'm not referring to killing him, I'm referring to restraining him.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody's going to come, if you feel you're threatened, you can restrain the person because he's threatening you.
He's not being threatened. The guy is just saying, leave me alone. That's it. He's saying, leave me alone. That's all there is. You know, to go back to our case of Mr. El Marty in the Toronto case, if the police officer doesn't stop him, right, and handcuff him and punch him and throw him to the ground, whatever, El Marty's walking on his way. The officer is in no danger. So that's part of this discussion. So we distinguish between three different issues. Number one, excessive use of force when you're carrying out the judge's instructions, where the judge said, do this. Number two, excessive use of force in trying to save someone's life, where you believe that this fellow is about to commit a crime and to harm somebody. And then excessive use of force when using your own discretion within the view that you're allowed to use force of Rabbi Isserles. So in carrying out the judge's instructions, it's actually very clear in Jewish law that assuming all one did was stick to what the judge said to do, even if the result was not what the judge expected, you're exempt from liability. You're indemnified. You are an agent of the court. So if the judge says, hit him, and the way that lashes were carried out historically was that there was a doctor on scene, and the doctor was supposed to say, we believe that this person can survive it. We can discuss, you know, corporal punishment and lashes and such, you know, later if you like. But the doctor said, this is fine. The fellow hits him with normal force. The guy collapses. There was an unknown heart defect or whatever it is. He's exempt from liability. Right, which he has to be, because otherwise he'll never find anybody to do that job. realistically. So he's protected. That's case number one. You did what the judge told you to do, you're exempt. If you exceed what the judge told you to do, then you are liable, because then you had no license to do it. Second category, you're saving somebody's life, right? That's what you think you're doing at any rate. So we've already said that you're allowed to kill the pursuer, although you're supposed to try to use as little force as possible in order to do it. But here's the question. Let's say you have somebody who is wanted for murder. You think to yourself, well, I better get him. You find him. You're a police officer, you're a detective, you do good work, you find out where he is, he starts running away. This fellow is known as a hardened criminal and a murderer. You're concerned that maybe if he gets away, he's going to kill somebody else. So do you draw your weapon and shoot him? You're not personally in any danger at the moment. He's running, his back is to you. Do you shoot him? Or do you say, well, I don't know that he's going to kill anybody else?
Depends if he's a
criminal. What would you say?
Do you know kind of guarantee that he's killed in the past? Or
yes.
Pre-trial.
It's pre-trial, so you can never know anything for sure. Let's say I have strong grounds to suspect. What I want to do is create a case where, as far as logic is concerned, you are 100% sure that this person is a murderer. If you want, it can be a case where he had been tried for murder and escaped after, was not acquitted, and then he escaped. So you know for sure that he's done it in the past. As far as the law is concerned, we believe he's done this before. Are you allowed to shoot him?
I would say yes, to protect the person who doesn't know.
Maybe shoot him in the face.
He's running away. He's not pursuing anybody. He's running away.
He's running away, right. So on the one hand, you can say, I need to protect innocent people who he could harm. And even if I say, well, I'm going to shoot him, but I'll shoot him in the leg, nonetheless, that's still an act of harming him. Like, you have to be justified in order to do that. So, in fact, this is a contemporary debate in Jewish law. How sure do you need to be? Source number 9, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, a chief authority in Jewish law in the latter half of the 20th century in the U.S., lived in New York, said he was dealing here in this response, and he's actually dealing with an abortion question. But his answer in the abortion question enters our conversation as well. You know that Jewish law regarding abortion is complicated. We are not as simple as the Catholic view on the one hand. We're not as simple as the liberal view on the other hand. We are complicated. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But in the case he's dealing with a case in which one, in fact, should not be allowed to do it unless you view the fetus as a threat to the life of the mother. And Rabbi Feinstein says, in such a case where you would be allowed to kill the fetus only because it's a threat to the life of the mother, he writes, one may not kill the fetus until the doctor's sense is strong, close to certain, that the mother would die otherwise if you didn't do this. Since the justification is that the fetus is considered a pursuer, it must be close to certain that it is a pursuer. Rabbi Feinstein says the standard is that you have to know for sure. You have to be close to certain that this is a pursuer. That's his stance. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, writing in Israel, more contemporarily, the last couple of decades, disagrees and says, no, a pursuer is killed even if it is uncertain that he is a pursuer. Even if you're not sure. However, there's a catch. And the catch is that Rabbi Lau's case that he describes is talking about where it is the intended victim who is acting against the pursuer. In other words, some guy's running after me. I don't know if he wants to kill me or not, but he has a weapon out. Maybe he just wants to shoot me in the leg. I don't know. So what Rabbi Lau could be saying is, I am not responsible to worry about the fine points here because I am the intended victim. Whereas the police officer, as a third party, may be required to inspect further in order to determine whether this fellow is in fact going to kill people or not. And indeed, Rabbi Chaim David Alevi, who I mentioned earlier, says the police officer would not be allowed to act in this manner. The police officer, like Rabbi Feinstein seemed to indicate, has to be sure, or as close to certain as possible, that this fellow is in fact a pursuer.
Does that mean that basically he can't shoot first? He has to be shot at before he can shoot.
Well, no, if you're dealing with being shot at, then I'll apply Rabbi Lau's standard in source number 10.
No, we haven't been shot at yet. How would you know?
Because the fellow is showing, he's acting in a way that demonstrates that you are his intended victim. If I am the target, then my threshold of proof is much lower. If I am not the target, my threshold of proof is higher. That's essentially what we're
but
putting
what
out
saying, here. If I'm a police officer who sees somebody running after something with a gun, I can't shoot at that guy until he shoots at me.
Say that again?
Let's say I'm a police officer who sees somebody running after a third party with a gun.
Yeah.
Since I'm a police officer, can I shoot at that guy even though he hasn't shot anybody yet?
Right.
I have to wait until he either shoots at the police officer. As I tell him to stop and he turns around.
Right. If he shoots at the police officer, the police officer is certainly...
He hasn't shot yet. I mean,
So I would look at it differently. If he draws his weapon on the police officer, then the police officer is licensed to shoot.
Right.
If he draws his weapon on this other person who he is pursuing, the police officer has to gauge. He has to figure out what does it look like this person is going to do. And if he thinks it's likely, then he has to protect the intended victim. If not, not. What if he gets it wrong? So I point you to source number 11, the code of conduct for the RCMP. Members use only as much force as is reasonably necessary in the circumstances. That is a Jewish law principle as well. It is as vague as it sounds, reasonably necessary, because we have a principle within Jewish law, Ein lo ledayan ela masha einav ro'ot. The judge only can work with that which his eyes see. So, he does the best he can, and he has to be able to defend his decision and explain how he did it. But at the end of the day, he's not responsible to be perfect. He just has to make his best estimate.
Yeah. Right. So, we have the case of the child who was shot, I think the Tamir Rice boy.
Yeah.
The officer thought he was carrying a real gun.
Yeah.
Do our sages talk about anything like that? Something that looks like a killer weapon, but in fact it's a toy.
Right. So in the sense that, not in terms of the specifics, plastic weapon looks like it's a real gun, but certainly what we're talking about here is exactly that case, where you believe that you are in danger. What we're saying is, as Rabbi Lau puts it, if it's your life on the line, you're entitled to act even without certainty. That seems to be the statement.
That's not what the parents of this Rice child are saying.
Are the parents ever going to say that?
Well, didn't you see that it was like a young person? Would he normally have a gun, a real gun?
Could. I mean, every day there are stories in the news about kid gets a hold of a gun and shoots somebody. I mean, I'm not dealing with that case,
himself,
especially. And I don't know, sorry?
Himself, especially.
Yes.
Yeah,
I don't know enough about the particular case to speak about that case beyond media reports. But what we're saying here is a person who feels himself in danger, police officer or otherwise, is entitled to defend himself and not get 100% certainty that he's in danger. But I want to move to the last of the categories here. We've said that when carrying out the judge's instructions, you have to do what the judge said, and then you're indemnified. When it comes to somebody who you believe is going to take someone's life, if it's the officer's own life, he does not have to be 100% sure. He just has to have a sense that he's in danger, a strong sense maybe. If he's dealing with saving a third party, he has to have a stronger sense than that. He has to be closer to 100% in order to justify the use of force. What about when it comes to using discretion in general? The officer who shows up at the fellow's house and the fellow refuses to come out, or the police officer who's sitting in the car, he's on the anti-violence unit, and this guy is walking down the street, and the officer senses he may have a weapon, he may be a dangerous person. What do we do at that point? According to Maimonides, the officer will be exempt from liability for violence that he performs in that capacity. He'll be exempt from liability. And I say that based on sources number 12 and 13. Source number 12 deals with the law of the city of refuge. Within Jewish law, we say that if somebody commits murder by accident, such as he's chopping wood and the axe slips out of his hand and it hits somebody. So he has to go to a city of refuge. It's an exile that he has to go through, both for his protection, so that the relatives of the murdered person are not going to attack him, and also as an element of punishment because he was careless in some way, leading to the death of this other person. And there's more to say about the city of refuge. But source number 12 says that requirement of going to the city of refuge is only because you were engaged in a voluntary activity like chopping wood. If you're an agent of the court, when you do this, then you don't have to go to the city of refuge. You were acting on behalf of the court, and therefore you will be exempt from liability. And indeed, source number 13, Maimonides writes, if he strikes the person who refuses to come to court, he is going to be protected from liability. Not only that, it may be argued, the court is going to trust the police officer's version of things. That's actually debatable, who the court is going to trust on this point. Source number 14, I'm rushing a little bit, but I'll try to make it clear as I go through. Source number 14 in the Talmud says that an agent of the court is believed, like two witnesses. Two witnesses is normally the standard of proof in Jewish law. The agent of the court is credible automatically. But then it clarifies that and says, that's only for shamta. That's only if we're going to carry out shamta, which is a form of excommunication. Then yes. However, if we're going to do any sort of punishment that's going to lead the agent's victim, the police officer's victim, to suffer a loss of funds, then he needs to be... He needs greater credibility. His natural credibility doesn't work. Which leads me to say, and not everybody agrees with me on this, but it leads me to suggest that the agent of the court, the police officer, will not have automatic credibility when it comes to a decision to harm somebody physically. He will not automatically be trusted. There's more to say within that, but I believe that to be correct. What we've said here, then, is that the police officer is licensed to use force, at least in carrying out a judge's verdict and in saving victims, and potentially even in other roles. If the police officer exceeds what he's supposed to use in carrying out the judge's instructions, he'll be liable. If he doesn't exceed it, he's fine. We said that if he kills someone to save an intended victim, that's fine. And if he was wrong, as long as he did what was reasonable, he's also going to be protected from liability. When it comes to using his own discretion, this is the last point that I want to make here. When it comes to using his own discretion, we say that he is going to be exempt from liability. That's what we saw in sources 12 and 13. He does not have to go to the city of refuge. He's going to be exempt. So here's my question to you. Why is he exempt from liability if he uses his own discretion and he ends up hurting the other person more than was appropriate? This goes back to the comment made about Baltimore in the very beginning, before we actually started the class. The answer seems to be because of a principle that we call Tikkun HaOlam. Tikkun HaOlam literally means repair of the world or improvement of the world. Source number 15 says, an agent of the court who strikes with the court's permission, he's licensed, and he causes harm by accident, is exempt. If it's on purpose, then he's liable. Why? Repair of the world. And what we mean by that, as explained in source number 16, Rabbi Shimon ben Samach Duran, writing in the 14th century, he says, if we wouldn't exempt him from error, from liability for error, he would refrain. He's talking about a doctor when he says refrain from healing. But the same thing is true for the agent of the court. If you're going to tell the police officer that if you make a mistake, we're not going to protect you, he's not going to be a police officer anymore. We have a similar idea in a case that came up in the 19th century. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, Chatam Sofer, dealt with this case. A woman had a maid working in her house. The maid fainted. The woman, in a panic to revive her, reaches for what she thinks is brandy and pours some down the woman's throat. It turns out it was actually kerosene. Killed her. But she was hasty because she was trying to save her life. So the question becomes, what responsibility do I have now for this? The woman wants to know, what am I supposed to do? And Rabbi Sofer is very lenient with her. Because he says, if we're going to hold people liable, then they're never going to act to save people's lives. Right? It's a Good Samaritan law, essentially. We need to protect people who are trying to do the right thing. Later authorities writing about that case clarify that it's because she's an amateur that she's protected. Meaning a professional has greater responsibility. A doctor in an ER can't say, well, I was just acting as quickly as I could. Because they're held to a higher standard. They're trained for those situations. An amateur is not. Applying that to our situation, the police officer has training. So he can't simply say everything happened really quickly. He has to be able to justify what he did in terms of the pressures that were brought to bear. But if he can justify it, then he will be protected because we need to make sure that we will have police officers. Just one... I want to make sure to get to the last point and we're hitting the 1 hour mark. There are limits to this exemption from liability. One limitation is source number 17, which is where he really should have known better as a professional. 17 is talking about a dentist who drills the wrong tooth. So he would be liable to pay because he should have known. That's negligence. A second area in which he would not be exempt would be if his motivation for doing it was cruelty. So I brought you in source number 18 where the fellow lashes out not in the course of a police action but rather because he's angry at the guy. He wants to hurt him. So that would not be protected. And then the last one would be if there's a need to make sure that police will be careful. That's source number 19. He's dealing there with a separate case, not a police case, but the principle that he pronounces there is relevant for us as well, that we may require somebody to pay sometimes as a penalty, even though he's not directly liable, because we want to make sure that they'll be more careful in the future. And that's what happens in the El Mardi case as well, in terms of the fines issued to the police, in order to ensure that they will be careful in the future. So what we have said is, number one, there is a position of a police officer biblically within a Jewish law, and the police officer has the same type of duties as the RCMP, carrying out punishments established by the court, enforcing the law, preventing crime. We've said that he is able to use force, at least in carrying out the punishments issued by the judge, as well as protecting people from harm, possibly also in terms of preventing crime in general. He may be able to use discretion in that department. He is exempt from liability in the event that what he does is as the judge instructed or was a reasonable attempt to save a victim. If it was in use of his own discretion, then it's a little bit dicier, but we do find that he has protection as long as he can defend that which he was doing. Assuming that, number one, he acted in a way that's appropriate for a professional. He wasn't doing this to harm the person personally. He was doing it because he felt this was necessary to carry out his duties. And assuming that we don't see something here that we need to rein in, then the police will be indeed protected from responsibility if they meet those criteria in order to ensure that we will have police officers to work on behalf of the community. There's more to say, but I think that basically is what I wanted.
Maybe a little bit off topic, but citizen arrest.
Yeah.
So you're basically not agents of the courts.
Right.
You're saying appointed agents of the courts. But is there such a thing as the Jewish law which would allow anybody to either refrain or to actually perform?
It's a really good question. The basic principle is that in order to be authorized to use force, you need ordination.
Right.
But ordination as what's called a samuha, a proper judge. The regular citizens are taught, and it's biblically required, that they're supposed to instruct people in right behavior. They're not supposed to be party to any wrong behavior, but they do not have license to use force in order to keep somebody from doing something wrong. And if the judge is
unreasonable,
the judge may be right.
So the
question that comes up often is what's called in the military pekuda b'li chukit be'alil, an instruction which is clearly an illegal order. Beyond that as well in this context. And yes, if the officer feels that what he's being told to do is wrong, then it's his responsibility to go to another authority and challenge what he's being told to do. Where it gets dicey is the ambiguous case, and where the judge says lives are at stake, and if you don't act, then someone's going to get hurt. That becomes more complicated, and he'll have to, you know, invoke what we saw for the RCMP in source number 11, which is he has to work with reason, and he has to do the best he can under the circumstances.
Can you make the distinction between the reasons police officers got into the prison to bring them to court? Like, if it's for something like theft, for instance, where there's no presumption of danger to the public as well as physical danger goes, how can we then associate it with a potential danger?
Right. So I would say two things. Number one, I agree with you. That yes, that has to be part of his thinking in terms of determining the level of danger involved. However, one thing that we did see, and I skipped over it in terms of really emphasizing it, but Maimonides mentioned it and the Code of Jewish Law mentioned it, is that we do have concern for the legitimacy of the system of courts. And that if people are going to flout the law and say, I'm refusing to go to court, the result is going to be that your court system falls apart. That will not necessarily license fatal force, but it may license lesser use of force in order to get this person to comply. That I think you will see. Yes?
So, again, I have to bring up the case of Nazi courts.
Mm-hmm.
So, supposedly established courts by, you know, but not reasonable courts, not courts that we would say are
right.
Humane courts, are thoughtful courts.
Right.
Yes.
And the answer is, if you believe that everything going on in your system of government is corrupt, it's your responsibility to get out of Dodge. Maimonides writes about this with the Jews in Morocco, living under the Almohads in the 12th century, and how they're being forced to accept Islam and so on and so forth. And he says, you know, they are responsible to move. A person cannot say, if every authority within the chain of command says this is okay, therefore it is okay. A person is not allowed to suspend his personal judgment to that extent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.